Hello, and welcome to one of our 8 case study museum interviews for the AMM Essential Questions Program series. Over the course of this series, we're finding out how museums are faring today, 3 years after the start of the pandemic and civic unrest following George Floyd's murder. We'll be chatting with 8 different museums across the Midwest about what they've learned about themselves and their audiences, what changes they've made that stuck, and what new models or approaches they've tried. These interviews are talk show style and feature guest moderators. They're pre-recorded so that you can listen to them when it is convenient, and listeners will have an opportunity to ask questions of our museum panelists during live Q&A sessions this spring. Stay tuned. Today's featured museum is the Anoka County Museum, well, Historical Society and Museum in Anoka, Minnesota. And today's interviewer is Richard Josie Jr., Principal of Collective Journeys. Richard, I'm going to pass the mic to you.
All right, thank you. So, Anoka County Historical Society. Let's start by introducing you all to the people. Rebecca.
Yes, sir.
Just give us a little bit about, you know, your name and just a little bit about you.
I'm Rebecca Ebnett-Dazens. I've been the director for going on 8 years now. I live on a farm out in Buffalo with some beef cows and really enjoy the oral history collection side of my job.
Perfect. Thank you. And next up, we'll have Cassie.
Yes, my name is Cassie. I am the collections manager, the archivist here at Anoka County Historical Society. And I have been here as a full-time employee now for 3 months, but have been here since 2021. I started as an intern. So it's been quite the experience. And like Rebecca, I grew up on a farm, so I have those rural ties, although, you know, hour and 20 minutes away, but now I am an Anoka resident, so happy to be here.
Thank you. And Sarah.
Yes, I am Sarah. I am technically the volunteer coordinator, and I still do that, but I also do a lot of the digital content and the, if we can dream it, let's make it happen person.
I like that. I like it. Thank you. So first question, you know, because we want to start in, as we think about, you know, the pandemic, and I think it's probably more appropriate to say pandemics. There are multiple things that were happening at that time, aside from the COVID. And so, Rebecca, I would just like to start with you as to, you know, when we reflect on the pandemic, did it present you with some, you know, we're hearing about, you know, opportunities, you know, challenges or struggles, you know, that the pandemic presented to us. I'd just love to hear, like, you know, from your standpoint, like, what did the pandemic do for you all?
It's not a popular thing to say, but we really enjoyed COVID. It really gave us the opportunity to rethink everything we were doing. You know, it was, museums never get the opportunity to just close. And there's always the public coming in. There's always the interaction. There's always outreach. And we had the opportunity to just stop. And we rethought open hours. We thought about how we could better serve people, you know, in the digital community. We thought about who we were as staff. We rethought a lot of board interactions. We were working with the Facing Change program at that point with the, you know, a few other museums down in the cities. It gave us the space to really dig into that because people weren't driving back and forth. So it really gave us the opportunity to stop and consider what was important to us and where we wanted to go in the future.
Thank you. Sarah, you volunteer coordinator extraordinaire with a few other things. What did the pandemic, from your vantage point, you know, what was going on with the pandemic for you?
Well, from the volunteer standpoint, a lot of the volunteer projects paused because people aren't coming into the museum to work on things. We weren't going to festivals and whatnot. And so my time kind of shifted a little bit into, all right, so what are the ways that we are reaching people? Like a volunteer coordinator, you're reaching people a lot. So let's keep those relationships of people knowing who we are in social media spaces and how we can showcase the collection when people can't access it physically in the building.
Right. Well, thank you. And Cassie, I know you came on in 2021, right?
Yeah.
Right about that. But you still have some remnants of it that you were coming into and, you know, dealing with afterwards. I'd love to hear, you know, how it impacted you as well.
Yeah. So when I started here as an intern, it was definitely, I'm a history major, so I've been to museums before, and it was definitely a considerably different experience. So when I got here to be a intern, they Anoka County had, you know, half of the exhibit hall set aside for us to work on this huge collection, which was, I mean, really, it gave us the space to kind of work through, you know, what we were dealing with when we were, you know, weeding through things and boxing up things, and just to have that space and not only like physical space, but like the mental space to be able to learn and grow. Because at that time I was still in school. So it gave me, I really think COVID gave me this chance to not be stuck in the back room somewhere. And also where we were kind of located in the exhibit hall, people were able to come up to us and ask us, you know, what are you doing? Yeah, you know, what are you working on? And we were able to kind of be that front facing also when those individuals would kind of putter in and trickle in. And so that was quite the experience. And we were talking as a group about how, you know, my perspective is kind of, I've never known the Historical Society in any other way except for, you know, this virtual kind of component always being a very core portion of what we're doing here. So.
Well, thank you. It's interesting when we consider, you know, the impact of, you know, these pandemics. And Rebecca, I'm coming back to a point that you were saying earlier in terms of, you know, the different way that it impacted you all. Everyone else, you know, you're hearing about, you know, how much of a challenge I was struggle is. And I'm not suggesting that it wasn't a challenge or struggle, but I'm curious to kind of dig in there a little bit, thinking about, you know, the impact of the pandemic. I hear that it's giving you all some degree of strength. I'm also curious as if they're, you know, I'm thinking about what strengths, you know, you come out of it with, but also, you know, just revelations, basically. What kind of revelations have you had from that?
Revelations. We're good. I think that really is was a revelation. You know, we're a small historical society, you know, in money as well as in staff. And for a lot of it, you struggle to find some meaning in what you're doing, to find your place within a larger organizations, to make a mark doing something that's fighting against the stereotype of just being the coffee clutch on the corner, right? And so this gave us the opportunity to stand up and say, you know, we are smart people, we are able, we are prepared, we are capable, we can in any circumstance think our way through it, react through it, and do it really well. And I think that confidence has really followed us in the last couple of years and is going to see the organization to a completely different level moving forward.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. I think it was Sarah, you were saying earlier when we talked before the call on some of the work that you do aside from the volunteers, you also do some work on some digital offerings.
Yeah, so scheduling all of the social media posts, you know, Facebook, Instagram, those places, recording and editing our podcast, which comes out twice a month on the first and third Friday of every month. And this is our third season. We have not missed an episode.
Wow.
I'm so proud of us. And creating digital video offerings of programs. So sometimes they're 45 minutes long, sometimes they're 5 minutes long, sometimes they're 2 minutes for quick shares, but recording and editing those together and putting them out in the world, or digitizing things for people to see, those sorts of things. So I've loved exploring those pieces of what we can share from the collection in that way.
So let me make sure I got this right. This pandemic comes.
Yes.
You all make this shift to begin to offer, you know, more digital offerings. What, like, did your visit, I hate to say visitation, but like, did your engagement grow? Did you see some growth in your engagement?
Yeah,
absolutely.
At the very beginning of the pandemic, we really wanted to do ways that would engage the entire county. And we did this like hashtag tour Anoka County thing. And we were connecting with people in every single city of our county and asking some of them to send in little videos of themselves in places back when you couldn't even like meet people. So they would send in this little clip of them walking around their local park or the church in Centerville, and the engagement of people interacting with those posts that they were exploring a new piece of the county when they were stuck inside was super fun. And the joy that we had in that creating, we kind of kept on going forward. Like, we can make little videos. Let's keep that going.
Huh.
Yeah. One of the other things that we did right out of the gate, like within a week of the shutdown, was to put out a survey. And we had, you know, a selection of questions, but we had over 220 responses from that survey. And we put out two more subsequent surveys to track people's reaction to COVID through the spring and early summer. So I think we took the skills that we were already doing, and we started just tracking what was going on. You know, like Sarah said, just engaging with the other humans that were out there in a way that they were able to at that point, meeting people where they were.
Gotcha. I did steal the microfilm reader from the museum and brought it home.
That was a secret.
Hey, Cassie, I'm pretty interested in, you know, because you deal a lot with, you know, actual items that, you know, touch, feel, see. And then we're talking about this sort of transition to making them available digitally. Did you have any challenges with that? I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, from your perspective as to how that, you know, how you all were kind of navigating that.
Right. I'd say that a bigger challenge was, you know, trying to discern what people wanted to see. So the digitization process in and of itself, it, you know, COVID let us get in there and take pictures and digitize some of the collection. Maybe we didn't have pictures of yet, you know, because we are a staff of three, and there is one collections manager. And yes, I have help with some of our other staff members and interns who have been, you know, instrumental in getting that whole ball rolling. But, once we got that up, that was, you know, something that researchers and different people could come look at. But just knowing what was most important to get digitized first has been, you know, kind of a challenge and kind of something that we have been kind of working towards now. Now we've had more time, but during COVID, it was like, well, where do we start, right? We have this big collection. So that was definitely something. Although when I came in, you know, in 2021, a lot of digitization efforts were focused on, you know, getting federal and a specialized collection done. And we've been kind of trying to do that too, revamping what, you know, kind of thinking about what our collection looks like. And focusing on specialized areas and trying to, you know, incorporate different communities around the county.
Got you. So the items that you have within that you, you know, digitized and the means by which you, how you make it available online, is that what is all part of what we call the vault, this sort of subscription service that you all have?
The digitization that I was talking about it's on collective access. So we have a database where we upload pictures you can go on to, I believe it's MN Collections. Is that right? Yep. And you can look at different things that we have in our collection that way. The vault has to do with, so I've been kind of dipping my toes into that. And the vault is something, it's a pay to play sort of a thing. And I've made a couple of videos about, you know, oh, come with me to deaccession this item so people can really see what it's like on the back end, right? Because a lot of people think of a collections manager and they don't think of the person that's making the videos and, hey, what's happening back there? They just know there's a person going through boxes and making, you know, decisions and making records. So it's been a nice way for the collections manager to kind of get out there and engage with those other humans.
I have to say, I love the idea of making it accessible for people to understand how we do what we do. Now, how history is constructed, you know, how we pull it together. I've been having a lot of conversations about that here recently. But then for you all to kind of put it into a subscription service, that just seems so interesting. What sort of lessons have y'all learned about that? Like, has that gone well just out of the gate?
I think from my perspective, we're in a odd position now in time where we've got three generations that we're trying to reach with communication. So you've still got the paper and pen folks. You've got the email crowd in the middle that are still pretty good with, you know, email blasts and digital newsletters and things. And then you have another group that's considerably younger that's grown up with Netflix and, you know, other subscription type ways to interact with the things that they love, or Patreons, you know, so that they can choose to support specific methods of communicating. And so the vault was our attempt at that subscription communication. And initially we offered it to our existing members for free, just to, as a benefit of their membership, as a perk. And now it's a $5 a month subscription that has grown exponentially from where it started. You know, so I see a definite growth pattern as far as, you know, bringing in financial help for the museum. And the challenge to us now is to continue to create content that's worthy of the $5 a month subscription, instead of just, here's the thing from our collection digitized, you can look at it. You know, so that was our baseline. And so now we need to up the ante for ourselves. And so that's where these videos that Cassie's making, or the lunch with the director things, where it's just vault members that can come to, you know, have a chit chat with me, or some of Sarah's programs, you know, that instead of being purchased separately, you know, they're part of the subscription, you know, so they come with that particular subscription.
Y'all might change the face of the field off of that one. Like, I'm so fascinated by that idea. What's also interesting to me is you mentioned a few times about films, and I understand you all created a film. What's it called? An Unwise Murder.
Yep.
Now, can somebody tell me about that? I would love to know a bit about that.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay. That was height of COVID, when we couldn't have anybody in the museum. We needed a fundraiser for the year. So you can't gather at one of those dinners or whatnot. So we decided to make a film. We have a rather large collection of lawyers' files from a lawyer from this area in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And one of the cases happened to be a murder in the township of Grow. And the case file was so juicy. It had a handwritten notes that the lawyer did, and transcripts, and all of this good stuff. So we took that in what we could have done with it and decided to make a true crime documentary. created the script and tagged awesome volunteers and board members to be a single human of embodying the lawyer or the prosecutor or witnesses. So we could meet one-on-one and record those and put it all together in one of those like Dateline or 60 Minutes-esque sort of things.
That is so intriguing to me. What, you know, it sounds like you all made this really inspiring shift during the pandemic, and you all feel pretty good about it from, you know, how you all talked about it. So I think it's safe to assume that there's been some positive audience response. So my question is more about what have you all learned about the audience in this sort of transition? I'll leave it there. I'd love to hear what you all have heard and what you all now know based off of what you've gotten from the audience.
People like to experience the history with you instead of going to some place where it's like just in front of you and you got to read the text. They like to experience it. And so the video was a new way that they had never seen from us or from anybody really in the area, of a way to engage with our local history in a super unique way. So I feel like that resonated. And if we have fun with it, it's going to come across and people are going to engage with it.
Yeah. And I did a program, an archival program in the library, which we didn't know how well that was going to go. Speaking of engaging with history, we really didn't know how well that was going to go. You know, who wants to learn about putting things in a box? But it was actually very popular. We filled most of the seats and people wanted to hear about, you know, engage with me. What are you doing back there? How do you properly do this thing? How can I, you know, put my artifacts into a box and make sure I have longevity? How can I do or preserve my history? Do history right, you know, do right by my history.
That we've seen you guys doing already.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it sounds cool. Like that, the idea of people experiencing something with you all and not having to be in person, that there's this moment of discovery, even through this sort of video, you know, technology that can be tapped into. So that's, now that does bring up another question. And, you know, in our world, we're always talking about, you know, how you measure success. Yeah, what is success? What have you been able to do, if anything, what do you do to assess whether it's successful or not? Like, are there, you know, because you mentioned surveys earlier, like, are there some findings and whatnot that you all have come out of the survey with?
The survey for COVID specifically was really interesting because the immediate answers that we got from the first survey were really raw, and they really reflected what people were feeling that particular second. The second survey we put out about a month later, we had half as many respondents. And just that showed us that people were getting overwhelmed. They were done. They were burned out. We don't want to talk about this anymore. The third survey was half as many again. And so while, you know, the answers stayed remarkably similar, you know, the engagement on that particular topic dropped off. You know, we had another one with the George Floyd murder, similar story. So we were able to capture some of the politics that were happening at the time. But I think we always talk about DEAI, you know, we always talk about accessibility. We always talk about going where people are and making sure that people feel welcome in the space. And suddenly with COVID, everybody was homebound, right? And so suddenly the disability community specifically was, you had a flavor of that. Everybody had a flavor of not being able to get in your car and go somewhere. And the restrictions that put on and the frustrations that so many people feel in our society. And the sense of not belonging and the sense of your community being upended and the sense of nothing is how it should be anymore. And just all of these things that pockets of our community feel on a day-to-day basis. And I think capitalizing on that helped people remember that, you know, accessibility and diversity is an everyday commitment that organizations need to make to their community. So we were able to take that back to our board and say, you know what, it worked. You know, there doesn't need to be a whole lot of planning. It doesn't need to be a strategic plan. It worked. What we did was good, and we can keep this moving forward, and we can be a better organization as a result. And that really helped prove to the board, you know, as far as, you know, measuring results, you know, it was proof to the board that our whim of experimentation was worth it.
Yeah. And you know what? You set me up perfectly, because I was just about to ask, with something like this, I'm very curious as to the board's perspective. You know, was that difficult to win them over, or I'm just curious as to how did that play out?
Again, it was another gift from COVID. They didn't have a choice. You know, everyone had to use Zoom. That was it. You know, you had to use OneDrive. You had to use the mechanisms that were in place, because you couldn't stop into the museum to get a paper copy anymore. The option wasn't there. So it pushed people who were uncomfortable into a place where they were very uncomfortable for a short space of time. But because everybody was floundering together, they didn't feel as self-conscious. So I think that was a real benefit, that we were all there together, and you didn't have one person standing out from another with that self-conscious. I think if we had gone to the board with any of these ideas, you know, the podcast, the murder, anything prior to COVID, we would have had a much larger of an uphill battle to try to get them through. You know, the murder itself took at least a couple hundred hours to put together one way or the other. Mm. You know, so equal to putting on an annual dinner, you know, it was an equal amount of work, but nothing that they would have been willing to trade the fundraising dinner for.
Right.
On an experiment.
Gotcha. You know, gotcha.
So yeah. So from that standpoint, I think it really, the board is very supportive of us.
And now that they learned the thing, it's becoming standard. Like, we can't get rid of it. You learned how to do the thing. Let's keep the thing going. So the last program that we hosted in person at the museum, we made sure to have people have the option to sign in and watch digitally as well. So having both going at the same time.
And we recorded it so that it can go on the vault.
Yeah, so I could add captions and then go on the vault.
Accessibility.
There exactly. You go.
I'm also curious as to, I imagine maybe it's the same, Sarah, with the volunteers. You know, we're all dealing with the same thing. So it was kind of easy to kind of get the volunteers, you know, to go with this as well.
Yeah. The volunteers, right in COVID, things kind of paused in our regular programming there, volunteer programming. And now have shifted a little bit more towards our volunteer needs are targeted towards, you know, those festivals and tours and more out into the community things to spread our history tentacles. Man, that's a poor phrase. And less of the people coming in and, you know, sitting and putting around and helping us with a random box. Because the time value of me teaching you how to organize this box versus other things is difficult to juggle. But in the volunteer world, we're making use of our resources digitally with things such as sign up Genius. So I can put a blast out there and say, okay, we need these shifts for this week-long county fair. And people are much more likely to, you know, sign up for the shift that works for them instead of emailing me for options, emailing back. And that there was a barrier to helping in that sense. So we're kind of going with the flow on that one. And if you know anybody that wants to be a ghost tour guide.
I might know a few people. Let me look into my Rolodex. So this place is, y'all have been a very interesting sort of place. You have this successful range of digital options, you know, for people, but you also had, you know, your in-person, you know, programs. And so how are y'all negotiating between, you know, the beloved in-person experience, you know, that people love, and then this new thing that you're doing online? How are you all kind of balancing, and like, what are y'all's thoughts in terms of how you're negotiating that?
There's no way that we can deny that we had 45,000 eyeballs on our website last year. We had 4,000 people that came in the museum to see the physical exhibit. So those numbers are so drastically different that we can't argue with ourselves that putting money and time and effort and energy into a physical exhibit is more important than putting it into the website and the digital programming. You know, we just can't. You know, the demand is clearly there. So the balance to strike there is, you know, the exhibit hall, maybe this year we chose a storytelling theme. So everything we put into the exhibit hall will be how to tell your story in this particular manner. And if your story looks like this, here's an example of how your story was told by someone else. But it's compartmentalized. So they're pop-up exhibits of, you know, maybe 3 to 4 foot square, and they're easily changed out. So as a collection item comes in, or as we rediscover a collection item, or as we meet someone who has a really interesting story, we can drop that into the exhibit hall in, you know, relatively short order and with relatively little time investment by comparison to, you know, flipping the entire 3,000 square feet into a cool looking exhibit.
Got you. Okay. Cassie, what sort of implications has this had in terms of your work?
In regards to the exhibit hall?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's actually made it a little bit easier. So it's tough to, especially when you're making an enormous exhibit, what things are we going to put on display? Like, what things do we have that are going to, you know, speak to the same exhibit, you know, for half of our exhibit hall? That can be a challenge, and sometimes it can be sparse. Whereas when you have this pop-up sort of a setup going on, you can find those most important items, or those most those items with the most reach, and really display those, you know, in a smaller space, and really have those, you know, connect with people more. So and investing time and finding, you know, those more important things. You know, obviously that's less time consuming than trying to hunt around the collection to how can I fill space? That kind of seems like a waste of time. So my time, you know, is much more well spent doing these pop-up exhibits. And I feel like people appreciate my efforts more when I'm going and getting those artifacts. Yeah.
So what I'm thinking about right now is care, more specifically self-care. Throughout the pandemic, you know, there was a lot going on in terms of, you know, be sure you take care of yourself, be sure you take care of yourself, be sure you take care of yourself. And we talked about sort of through the pandemic, you've morphed and adjusted and, you know, and looking at things a little differently. did the pandemic impact how you all look at self-care? Any, and I would just love to hear, like, are you taking care of yourself now? Like, I'm curious as to what the pandemic did for you in terms of how you're looking after yourself and your staff and your volunteers and everybody.
We are an extremely lucky group in that we look out for each other and we have each other tapping us on the shoulder and saying, get out of here, you've done enough, or shut down, you've done enough, or Sarah, take your flipping PTO before you lose it by the end of the year. And I think that's really special to us as a staff. You know, we have volunteers that make catnip toys for, we all have cats. You know, I mean, we have that type of relationship with people that, you know, it goes beyond just the brownies and donuts showing up in the break room. Oh, you know, what was that?
I recorded their reaction today. So we just got new lights in the Philo room, which is our big meeting room. Mm-hmm. And we have quilters that come every Wednesday to quilt together. And they've been complaining about the low level of light. So we were very proud that we got them new lights today. Before they came, I made them a big bow for the door that said to the quilters. And I put like red crepe paper dangling all around it. And so that was my morning of caring for our visitors in that way.
Good. Good. That's going to be I'm starting to hear this a lot in terms of, you know, how people are, you know, managing themselves now, and that the pandemic was basically a catalyst for how we look in the mirror a little bit more and see where we, you know, need to care for self. I just got a few minutes left and I really have one last question I just would love to hear from each of you all. And that is, you all have this platform now and all these people are watching you all and listening. We're talking about the success of the digital world that you all have embarked in. Just a variety of things you spoke about. What is something that you would want to convey to the field at large now? That may be looking at similar changes that you all have made?
From my perspective as a director, would be to let your staff be wonderful and not to hamper who they are, and to let the idea generation happen, and to then believe in them to say, you know, when Sarah turned around and said, I can learn how to produce a video. Sure, why not? You know, and what do we have to lose, really? And it turned out great. You know, so to recognize that the people that work in museums are fabulously gifted people and very conscientious as a general rule. And the people that I've met in the museum world are not ones that are going to, you know, screw the system over. They're really not. They're too good of people. So to let them experiment and give them that space to do the thing, and I think that's been a wonderful lesson.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
I think also we're good researchers, and that's a skill that extends beyond delving into the boxes that you so carefully put on the shelf. Mm-hmm. That it goes into, we can learn how to do just about anything. YouTube and LinkedIn Learning are amazing. Mm-hmm. You can learn to do just about anything.
Yeah, and you know, have some, I mean, I'm starting off, so you know, I'm kind of a beginner here. And just having, you know, obviously being on a team that's confident in my abilities is helpful, but just be confident in yourself. You have the support system there. Be confident that you can go out, you know, read a thing, learn how to do it, put in some time and effort, and you'll be able to get there.
And if you stumble, we're both there.
Yeah. Don't dwell on it.
The beautiful thing that y'all have said, I've been doing some work here recently on psychological safety and how that you know, contributes to, you know, creating a space where DEAI is just normal, that it can, DEAI exists easily in spaces where people feel psychologically safe. And in the conversation that you all the things that you just said could be an ad for psychological safety elsewhere, because that's what it really boils down to, is sort of inclusion safety and contributor safety and learner safety. And so I just thank you all so much for, thank you all for your time and your sharing. I think people in the field are going to really benefit from the things y'all have said. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome.